Good afternoon. I want to try to tell you a little about my life and what influenced me ultimately to go to law school, and then talk a bit about my practice, because my practice primarily involved litigating civil rights and civil liberties cases. So at any point, you know, if you feel the urge, just throw your hand up and I'll interrupt and answer any question that you have. I grew up in Norfolk, Virginia, and when I went to school, public school in Norfolk, Virginia, the state was segregated by law. Throughout my public school education, all of my fellow students were black students. All of my teachers were black. All of the guidance counselors, principals were black. across town, all of the white kids went to school with only white kids. The South was sort of strange at that time because they classified Chinese as white and some Indians as white and some Puerto Ricans as white. It was a very odd kind of classification. But they went to school together, and they were taught only by whites, and all of their principals and guidance people were white. In 1959, so you calculate my age, right? when I was about to go into the ninth grade, a federal judge, now this is 5 years after Brown, a federal judge ordered the Norfolk School Board to admit 17 black students to formerly all-white schools. these students were selected by people in the black community because they thought those students could handle what they were about to face. They applied, many more than 17 applied. The school board essentially whittled it down to about 3 or 4 students. The federal judge made them make another decision. They picked 17. And these students were assigned to attend the white schools. There were 3 white high schools in Norfolk, Maury, Granby, Norview. And the black school that I attended was Booker T. Washington High School. There were, at that time, I believe, 2 white junior high schools, Northside and Blair, don't hold me to that, and 2 black junior high schools. Now, when these kids were assigned to these schools to desegregate the schools, the governor, who was J. Lindsey Allman, closed the schools. The state of Virginia, for many, many years prior to that time, had been sort of the intellectual leader of the segregationist South. The lawyers who came from the University of Virginia and William and Mary and other state schools back in the 30s and 40s were the intellectual brain trust for the South. They devised legal systems to thwart any type of desegregation. And in 1959, the state of Virginia had something called massive resistance laws. And we used to say that the idea was that the state would massively impose its sovereignty to thwart the federal government. Forget the Supremacy Clause. The idea was to impinge upon the Supremacy Clause. And this was not a new idea in Virginia. I was reading Ron Chernow's book on Alexander Hamilton not too long ago. And one of the things that happened back when the founders were putting together this government was the southern states tried to, again, impose their state sovereignty to avoid certain issues around slavery and to keep the federal government from getting there. And they were Virginia people. Either Madison or Jefferson, I'm not sure which, it escapes me, but they were in the forefront of that. Virginia, and this doctrine was called the imposition and nullification, you know, to impose state sovereignty, to nullify the federal government and the federal laws. It happened again at the time of the Civil War. It was resurrected in 59 to avoid school desegregation, and actually it recently happened. The Congress passed Health Care Act. Virginia's response to that was to pass a law that essentially said that no federal official, I think, could require any Virginia resident to buy health insurance. That's another manifestation of, in my judgment, this doctrine of imposing state sovereignty to thwart federal government. So, at this time in 59, the governor, J. Lindsey Arman, using the legislation, closed the schools in Norfolk. But the law said you could only close the schools that were being desegregated. And so the three white high schools were closed, the two junior high schools were closed that were white schools that were being desegregated. And the only schools, high school left open was the black high school and the black junior high, two of the black junior highs. So the white kids were out of school. The black kids were going to school. The 17 black students who were assigned to those schools were taught in a church basement. The group of people in the black community who decided it was time to challenge this rule decided that they would set up a school for the black students in the church basement. They could have come back to the black school, but it was thought that that would cause some problems with the litigation. They didn't want to create any difficulty, so they said, "We won't go. We'll teach them in the basement of the black school." The white students had no schooling. Now, what happened was one of the local jurisdictions nearby, the city of South Norfolk, I believe it was, decided that they would go on sort of a half-time and rent their schools out to this private foundation, and they would school the white kids from Norfolk who could pay, and they could go to South Norfolk and go to school. This went on from September until February. Schools were closed. In February, a federal court, and all during this time there was litigation pending in the federal court. It was litigation brought by the black parents who initially forced this desegregation. And I believe, I'm not certain of this, but I believe that a group of white parents intervened and with the Justice Department, and two suits were going forward at that time. Now, Norfolk is a very interesting place. It's a southern town, but it's a Navy town. And there are a lot of people there who are not traditionally Southerners. They come from wherever all of you come from, Jersey, California. Every Navy person at some point in his or her life gets assigned to Norfolk, largest naval operating base in the world. There are six or seven installations, huge, huge naval presence. And the federal government gives to the local school system money to compensate for them taking these strange students from all around the country into the school system while their parents are stationed in Norfolk. Right? So at the time this was going on, there was a little bit of pressure from the Navy because Navy kids weren't getting educated. Right? White parents, as I said, I believe, intervened in the lawsuit. The black parents are pushing to get this thing going. And the federal court and an order from the state Supreme Court caused the school system to open the schools in February. And the kids went back to school. Black kids went to school. And it was a very difficult time for those. I know personally all 17 of those kids. And it was a very, very difficult time for them during the 4 or 6 years that they endured being in that environment. I was telling the professor there's a classic photograph of a fellow named Reginald Young, who's a good friend of mine, in the Maury High School auditorium. He's sitting there, and the closest kid to him is about 10 rows away from him. And that was the kind of isolation that they faced in order to bring this about. One of the dirty, dark secrets that nobody ever talks about is this. One-fourth to one-third of the white kids who were out of school never went back to school. They were poor kids. They didn't have money. They couldn't afford to pay to go to South Norfolk. They simply dropped out of school, and when the schools reopened, they never went back to school. One of those collateral consequences of this crazy decision to keep the races segregated. So I go into high school in 59, and at this time, there are all kinds of things going on, civil rights marches. I got involved with a group of students from my high school and from Norfolk State University, and we were picketing department stores, food places, hotels, because they would not serve black people in their establishments. One of the inspirations for us was a chemistry teacher that I had. Her name was Aline Hicks. Aline Hicks had sued the Norfolk School Board in 1939 or 1940 because she was a teacher at Booker T. Washington High School, and black teachers were paid half the salary of white teachers. Now remember, this is a time of Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal, right? So the school systems were separate, black students, white students, black teachers, white teachers. The black teachers were paid half the salary of the white teachers. Aline Hicks filed a lawsuit. Her lawyer was Thurgood Marshall and a fellow by the name of Oliver Hill from Richmond, Virginia. They filed a lawsuit on her behalf in state court. The state court judge ruled against her. She appealed, and while the case was on appeal, the school year ended, and the school system fired Aline Hicks. And when the school system fired Aline Hicks, they filed a motion in state court to dismiss the appeal because it was moot. She was no longer a teacher. She couldn't bring an action for her pay. The state court dismissed the lawsuit. State court dismissed the lawsuit. Aline Hicks went to Columbia Teachers College and worked on her master's degree. Or actually, she had a master's. She was working on a post-master's degree. And Thurgood and Oliver Hill found another teacher who was willing to take the case. His name was Alston. I think it was first name in a minute. But he agreed, and they filed another lawsuit. They filed this time in federal district court and ultimately prevailed. The Norfolk school system was required to equalize the teacher salary. This happened in 1940. And every student since that time who took chemistry from Aline Hicks learned the story of Oliver Hill and Thurgood Marshall and her fight to equalize her salary. And I learned it from her. That was one of the things. She was one of my heroes in life because she taught us some things and caused us to become aware of things that we had pretty much been complacent about. I left high school in 1962, got on the Greyhound bus with two suitcases, went to Philadelphia, and went to college, and went there with no intention of ever returning to the South again. when I got to Philadelphia, I roomed with two guys, Densmore and Berg, my two roommates. They both were going to law school. I was a math major. We often talked about law, what law could do, and why they were going to law school, and why I was going to be a mathematician. And I was going into math because at this time in the United States, at least where I live, the only good job that black people had were teaching. IBM wasn't hiring black people. They couldn't go down and work for the school board or for the city government. And so when I thought about a career, people that I looked at, because I didn't know any lawyers or any judges or doctors or dentists, were teachers. And I decided I thought I was pretty good in math. I wanted to be a math teacher. And so that's what I did. And in Philadelphia, I got involved again in some civil rights marches, particularly around a school there. There's a school in Philadelphia, and it was for white male orphans. Anybody here from Philadelphia? I can't remember the name of the school, but anyhow, that was there, and there were marches around, and I got again involved in civil rights activity, and I also got involved in Vietnam anti-war activity with the anti-war mobilization. And I did my 4 years, and when I left, I went to graduate school in mathematics, but I was thinking about law. I decided to take the LSAT during that summer just on a whim, and I applied to law schools. One of my professors, and when I was in Chicago, I got involved in a group called the Mobilization Against Vietnam, and there were big marches there, and it was a very interesting time because Jesse Jackson at that time had something called the Rainbow Coalition in Chicago, and Martin Luther King came to Chicago, and there was a march through Cicero, and it was a very violent march. He almost got killed in Chicago in Cicero, which was at that time was sort of an all-white community on the west side of Chicago where Mayor Daley lived, the mayor of the city. And so I've always gotten involved in college and in graduate school in both anti-war and school desegregation or desegregation issues. One of my professors suggested to me that I apply to my state school. And, you know, as I said, when I left, I had no intention of coming back. And I thought about it. And when I left high school, there was when this litigation was going on in 1959 to desegregate the schools, as I said, there were a group of white parents that intervened. And after that litigation, they set up a scholarship fund. When I left high school, I got a scholarship from this fund. And one of the persons involved in that was a fellow named Bob Nussbaum, who is a lawyer in Norfolk and who went to the University of Virginia. So when my professor suggested that I think about going to my state school, I got in touch with Bob and said, you know, I'm thinking about going to school. Tell me about this. Law schools in Virginia, and he told me about them, and he suggested I try Virginia, and I tried, and I got in. And the good news was it was $250 a semester tuition. Right? And the bad news was it was the South, and it was in Charlottesville, a small town. That was not particularly an interesting place. I came to Charlottesville, and when I came to the University of Virginia, it was in Clark Hall. There were 750 students in the law school. There were 5 black students. Jim Gay was in the 3rd year. Robert Williams, Lester Moore were in the 2nd year. Elaine Jones and I were in the 1st year. In my class, entering, this is in 1967, we had the largest group of women ever to enter. There were 13 in the class of 250. It was a very different time. ironically, of the 5 black students there, 4 of them went to Booker T. Washington High School in Norfolk. I have yet to figure out how that happened, but I knew all 4 of those students, because there was only one high school in Norfolk. If you were in the 10th grade, you knew everybody in the 11th, 12th grade or people in the 9th grade. So I knew them. And they all gave us lessons about who to look out for and what to watch out for. Now, Elaine Jones had come here from the Peace Corps in Turkey. And I didn't know she was coming. We just happened to look across. We would meet in front of Clark Hall the first day. Everybody had a suit and tie on. You had to wear, you know, tie was required. And I looked across and I saw this black female over there. And she saw me and she waved. And I said, Elaine, that was Elaine Jones, right? She had been in the Peace Corps. And she's coming back to the States, going to law school. On her third, fourth day in the law school, she was down in the ladies' room. And she'd done whatever she was going to do, and she was standing there washing her hands, looking in the mirror. And a woman who worked in the admissions office came out of a stall and said, when you finish that, put some toilet paper in the stall, please. She thought Elaine was a worker there. And that was Elaine's initial time at the law school. It was an odd place. I was in the stacks one day, and I was going up the stairs, and one of my professors was coming down the stairs, and I said, good morning, professor. He looked at me and kept walking. So it was, for me, it's a very different kind of experience than I had had either in undergraduate school or in graduate school. just to tell you a sort of a funny story. In the third year, I had decided I was going to practice in Virginia. Elaine decided that she might. And we thought we would take a case called Virginia Procedure. Because at that time, nobody, of all the courses that I had in my first 3 years, 2 years, I never learned anything about Virginia law. I mean, they just, there were no cases of any importance. And so I decided that if I'm going to practice law in Virginia, I should take Virginia Procedure. And the other upper class people said, don't take this guy. He's deadly. Black kids don't pass his course. And Elaine and I talked, and I said, you know, Elaine, if you take the course, I'll take the course. I said, because I need to learn some Virginia law. She said, okay, we agreed to take the course. We took the course, and the first day we go into class, the professor comes in, and the professor's blind. And he sort of makes a funny remark. You know, I see there are a lot of women in the class. And he said, more women than I've ever had. I remember the first time we had women here, and I had this woman, and she took my class, and she didn't do well, and she came into my office, and she just boo-hooed. And ever since then, I have decided that I just will pass the women who take my course. And Elaine passed me a note. And I looked at it, and the note said, you're on your own. we both passed the course. we both recommended to upcoming students to take the course because it was a good course. You know, it's just one of those little quirks in life. while we were here, as I said, Virginia had a tradition, the law school had a tradition of admitting one student, two students. And in my second year, a fellow by the name of Monrad Paulson came to the school as dean. And Monrad came from NYU, I believe. He was an expert on domestic and juvenile law. And Elaine and I took Monrad out to dinner one night, and we had food and a couple of beers, and we talked. And we said, Monrad, you know, we got to do something about this. And we talked and we talked. And the outcome of that talk was the next year, they admitted 13 black students. They doubled the number of women in the enrollment. And the school, hopefully, has never looked back. I always say that Monrad is another one of those persons that I sort of consider a hero. While I was in my third year, the law students invited this lawyer, Oliver Hill, to the law school to talk about Brown versus Board of Education. Oliver was one of the lawyers in that case with Thurgood Marshall. Now, you probably know Brown consisted of four cases, well, five maybe, but there were four cases in the Brown case. Brown versus Topeka out of Kansas. There was a case from Clarendon County in South Carolina, and there was a black lawyer there, Matthew Perry, who later became a federal judge. There was a case from Delaware. That's a lawyer named Louis Redden there, who was a great trial lawyer. And a case from Virginia. And the case from Virginia came from Farmville of Prince Edward County. And so Oliver, along with Thurgood and Spotswood Robinson, a couple of lawyers, litigated the Brown cases. He came and he talked to us about his experience with the Brown case. He told us about Charles Hamilton Houston. He was a black lawyer who went to Harvard Law School back in the 20s. He was law review. He went to Howard University after he graduated. Howard had a part-time night law school. And Charles Houston and a fellow by the name of Jim Neighbord decided that they were going to challenge this whole system of segregation in the United States. The NAACP and black lawyers had been litigating these separate but equal cases to be sure that things were equalized. And they made the decision that that was not good enough, that they were going to file lawsuits to challenge Plessy versus Ferguson. And they did. And after Oliver talked, I went to him and I introduced myself to him. I said, I'm from Norfolk, Virginia. When I was a student, we did sit-ins and picketing, and you came down and talked to us about what we could do and what we could not do under the law. And he said, oh, and you're in law school here? He said, I'm going to offer you a job. I mean, he offered me a job right on the spot. That's about right. So I was in my third year, and I had applied to, you know, the firms would come in and interview, and I interviewed with one firm. I can't remember who it was. And I interviewed with Justice Department in the Civil Rights Division and had an awful interview with them and decided I wasn't going to go work there. Finally, I got an offer from NAACP Legal Defense Fund in New York, and I had this offer from Oliver in Virginia. And between Oliver and Legal Defense Fund and me, we worked out an arrangement where I would go to the law firm and work in the law firm as a employee of part-time of Legal Defense Fund and part-time of the law firm. And Legal Defense Fund did that for about five other people that same year. Elaine Jones turned down an offer. She had an offer from a big firm, Nixon's firm, Mudge Rose. And she decided to turn that down, and she went to work for Legal Defense Fund. And so Fund, at that time, was litigating civil rights cases all across the country. They had five of us in the field, a fellow by the name of Mel Watt. Is in North Carolina. Mel is now a representative in Congress. A fellow named Sanford Bishop in Alabama. Sanford is a representative in Congress. A fellow named Dave Corr, who was in Georgia. And Dave is now a bankruptcy judge in Chicago. I don't know how Dave got to Chicago from Alabama, but there he is. And there was a woman, Bernice, and she became a trial lawyer also, and she was in Mississippi. So I went to Hill, Tucker & Marsh, and I began to litigate civil rights cases, and that's what I did for 6 years. We handle pretty much every civil rights case in the state of Virginia. That firm litigated every school case across Virginia. And so as a lawyer, I started litigating cases, and I became of counsel in the Norfolk school case, which was very interesting to go back and try this case. One day the superintendent went on a rant while he was on the stand about outsiders coming in and litigating these cases and creating problems. And when he got off the stand, I went over to him and I introduced myself and I said, I'm a graduate of Booker T. Washington High School. He said, when did you graduate? I told him 1962. And the next day he came in and he said, oh, I saw your records. He said, you're one of the reasons why we should have kept a separate system. You know? I said, okay. But we tried these cases. We tried public school cases. I tried a case involving higher education out of Petersburg. The South has a number of traditionally black colleges, and Virginia has its share. In the city of Norfolk, there was a school, when I was in high school, there was a Norfolk division of Virginia State College, which was a black school. There was a Norfolk division of William & Mary, which was a white school. They're 7 miles apart. They absolutely duplicate every course that they had. Over time, the William & Mary School became Old Dominion, and Norfolk State is now Norfolk State University. They still have a large duplication. Two state schools, 7 miles apart. The only reason they are there is this state had a dual system of public higher education. In Petersburg, there's a school called Virginia State University. 5 miles away from Virginia State is a place called Richard Bland College. Richard Bland is owned by William & Mary. It is a two-year institution. William & Mary decided that they were going to escalate Richard Bland to a four-year university. The State Council on Higher Education recommended that Richard Bland go into the community college system. A legislature at that time said to several people who we were able to put on the stand that he wanted a white school on the south side of Virginia. Richard Bland was going to become that. We filed a lawsuit to enjoin the state from making Richard Bland College a four-year institution. We asked for a lot of other relief, some of which was granted, some of which wasn't. But ultimately, we got a declaratory judgment that the escalation of Richard Bland to a four-year institution would have perpetuated the state system of segregation and got a permanent injunction keeping Richard Bland from becoming a four-year institution. So we had a number of cases across Virginia that raised issues like that. I also became involved in, and this happened sort of tangentially through my work with the Vietnam War resistance with the ACLU. I became a member of the board of ACLU, and as a consequence, I became involved in a lot of litigation that involved non-civil rights issues. At that time, a lot of litigation was being brought in Richmond, Virginia. And it was being brought there because there was a great federal judge there, a guy by the name of Bob Marriage. Bob Marriage, when I was at the University of Virginia, the undergraduate school was all male. Virginia had a tradition. William & Mary used to be all male. Virginia Tech was all male. University of Virginia was all male on the undergraduate level. They had women in the graduate schools. And several women, I think there were four, filed a lawsuit to get rid of that bar at the University of Virginia. And Bob Marriage was a judge on that case, did a masterful job, ordered University of Virginia to admit women in all of its levels of education. One of the things about the Eastern District of Virginia also, in addition to having a great judge in Bob Marriage, was something we call the rocket docket. Cases got tried, and you would file a case in the federal court. In 30 days, you would have a status conference, and at that status conference, you would have to come in, bring your dates for your trial, and the trial would be set. And it was not unheard of that a case would go to trial 6 months after it was filed in the Eastern District of Virginia. Now, I tried a lot of cases with lawyers from New York and New Jersey and Chicago. They would come down, and we would be local counsel with them, and they couldn't believe it. Because if you file a case in Southern District of New York, it might take 3 years, 4 years to get trial. They couldn't believe that they would have to go to trial in 6 months. And I said, you're going to go to trial in 6 or 9 months. You got to be prepared, you know. And, of course, as local counsel, I had to be prepared because if they didn't show up or they had some problem, and the case got called, you had to try the case. As a consequence, I got involved in cases with Ralph Nader's group, Public Citizens, Alan Morrison. Virginia had a had a statute that barred pharmacists from advertising drug prices. And so, in the black part of town, the Valium was very, very cheap. In the white part of town, Valium was sky high. In the white part of town, hypertension drugs were very cheap. In the black part of town, hypertension drugs were very high. And it was all because the pharmacists were pricing according to the consumers in their areas. And nobody knew it because they couldn't advertise their prices. A couple of pharmacists decided there was a problem with that, and a group called Virginia Citizens Consumer Council, along with legal help from the Nader group, we filed a lawsuit and knocked out the Virginia law that barred advertisers from advertising drug prices. Consequence, drug prices went down all across. We also, I as a lawyer, I sued the Virginia State Supreme Court, which is very interesting. the Virginia Bar Association had a rule also that prohibited lawyers from advertising fees. You could not say that for a uncontested divorce, you know, it costs $500. If you did, it was an ethical violation. The same group, Consumers Council, decided that they wanted to put together a brochure of lawyers in Northern Virginia, and they wanted to put in how many lawyers there were in the firm, what foreign languages they spoke, what kind of cases they handled, and what the fees were for those cases. And Consumers Union, the people that put out Consumers Reports, partnered with them and sent out surveys. And uniformly, the lawyers sent them back saying, we can't give information about fees. And we went, talked to the people, and I knew it. And there was one woman, a lawyer up in Northern Virginia, who said, I think we ought to challenge this, and we filed a lawsuit. And there used to be something called a three-judge federal court. I don't think they exist anymore now. But if you had certain kinds of litigation, constitutional litigation, you get a three-judge federal court. And a lot of those were filed, again, in Richmond, because Bob Marriage was there, and the Fourth Circuit at that time was a decent circuit. Got to be the pits later on. It is now coming back. But at that time, it was a decent circuit, and so a lot of this litigation was filed. We filed that, and we lost it, and that is, the court said you could not get lawyers did not have a right to advertise the fees. Appeal to the United States Supreme Court. While that case was on appeal, another case went up from Arizona versus Bates, which raised the very same issue. The Supreme Court took Arizona Bates, held our case in abeyance, decided Arizona versus Bates, and ruled that it was a First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, 14th Amendment violation to bar lawyers from advertising their fees. Our case was sent back on remand for reconsideration, and the three-judge federal court, in light of Bates, found that it was a violation for the Virginia Supreme Court and the bar to bar fees. And then we asked for attorney fees. We asked that the Supreme Court pay our attorney fees. Now, mind you, in the meantime, I'm practicing law in Virginia, and I'm having cases argued before the Virginia Supreme Court. And it's quite an experience to stand before a court who you are suing in federal court, deciding your cases. The Supreme Court went ballistic because they said it was unheard of that you could sue a court for damages. And we said, well, that may be, but this is not a damage suit. You know, we filed a civil rights action under 42 U.S.C. 1981-83. And under that rationale, we are entitled to fees under 1988. and we litigated, and we won that. We won that lawsuit, requiring the Supreme Court to pay our fees. In 1985, I became a judge, and the Court of Appeals was newly created. There was no such thing as a Court of Appeals in Virginia. We had trial courts, and then we had one Supreme Court. All cases were appealed from the trial court directly to the Virginia Supreme Court, and they all went by petition. It was a discretionary appeal. As a consequence, every year, the Virginia Supreme Court took 200 cases, no more. And if you weren't VEPCO or AT&T, the likelihood of your getting an appeal granted was almost nil. The legislature in 85 created the Court of Appeals of Virginia, gave us half the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, gave us appeals of right, and they then appointed 11 judges to the court. I was one of those judges. I was the only one who was not previously a trial court judge. And the first day that we met, who walked in to greet us was the chief judge of the Virginia Supreme Court. And he walked around and he spoke to everybody. He came to me and he shook my hand and he held my hand and he held my hand. And we talked, and we have a great relationship. But it was a very interesting experience doing that.